process of secularization, the strategy we should follow in trying to stem that trend, and the best means of organizing politically. With respect to the last issue, we would seem to have two options. One is to join the Christian political parties as the CHP. The other is to do what many Christians south of the border are doing, is to organize the Christian Alliance and so to try to influence other mainline parties. In the United States, that would be the Republican one. In Canada, the most likely the progressives. Now, my presentation is meant as an introduction to these discussions. It will not deal with Christian politics in Canada as such, at least not directly. I will focus instead on the Netherlands and on the way reform believers in that country have tried to fulfill their political calling. The reason why this topic was chosen is not that the Dutch model can serve as a blueprint for us here in Canada. This should be stressed at them right at the start, for to ignore it can easily lead us astray. After all, as reformed people of mainly Dutch descent, we have been influenced by the Dutch tradition. And one of the reasons why we have been hesitant to get involved in politics here may well be this Dutch heritage. That is, we are still harbor the conviction that the only acceptable political organization is with committed Christians, preferably Reformed Dutch. The fact of the matter is, however, that the Dutch system does not really fit the Canadian context. Canada lacks a tradition of professional parties. Christians have generally voted here for a mainline party. Canada also has no proportional representation. The man or woman who gets the highest number of votes in a riding gets elected. The votes that cast for competing candidates are lost. And as long as Christians form a minority in each of Canada's 308 ridings, their votes are wasted when cast for a separate party. And this is unlike the Dutch system, where votes are counted nationally, so each small party has a chance of getting representatives in Parliament. The Canadian situation then discourages the type of political involvement that is possible in the Netherlands. But it does not mean that the history of that involvement should be ignored. We can learn a lot from it with respect to strategy and organization, and also with respect to the nature of Christian politics. That is, it can help us find an answer to the question as to what truly Christian politics involves. For a century and more, Reformed thinkers in the Netherlands have attempted to formulate biblical principles on this issue, and their work should not be forgotten. In paying attention to it, we should know not only the positive insights and achievements, however, but also the failures. After all, as a recent American philosopher has told us, those who ignore the mistakes of the past run the risk of having to repeat them. Now, the history of Reformed politics in Holland can be divided into two phases. The first one began in the late 1800s and lasted into the second half of the 20th century. The second began after World War II and continues today, although there is evidence of decline. My main concern is in this second phase, but to explain its origin and character, something must be said about the first one as well. At the beginning of the first phase, the dominant power in the Netherlands were the liberals. They controlled the government, the universities, the schools, and much of the rest of society. Even so, their rule did not remain unopposed. There were three groups that challenged the liberal monopoly. They were the Orthodox Protestants, or Reformed, the Roman Catholics, and the Social Democrats. Each of these had its own political party. The Reformed was the anti-revolutionary one, of Bruno Finster and Abraham Kuyper. A big issue for both Reformed and Roman Catholics at the time was the school system, which had become increasingly secularized. Reformed and Roman Catholics were allowed to establish their own schools, but they had to pay for them themselves, together in an attempt to remove this injustice, and their cooperation paid off. In 1917, a law was passed that guaranteed full financial subsidy for separate schools, to which the socialist support, the two religious parties, agreed to the socialist demand that all adult male citizens receive the right to vote. What we have in these developments is the start of a typically Dutch phenomenon, namely that of polarization. Dutch word for it is verzuiling. This term refers to the organization of society into separate groups or pillars that are distinguished by their worldviews. Each of the four pillars has its own media, its own socio-economic organizations, its own radio broadcasting, often even its own choral and sports groups. In addition, the religious pillars, we call them the Catholic, have their separate schools, colleges, and universities. All pillars were and still are equal in the sight of the government, and could, if certain conditions were met, count on full financial support, not only for the schools, but they support other activities as well. During the first half of the century, the system of pillars had a good deal of support from the Reformed and Roman Catholic constituencies. The religious parties often formed the government at the time. After World War II, however, enthusiasm for pillarization declined. The theology of Karl Barth played a role here. People also remembered that during the war, in their resistance against Hitler, liberals, socialists, and communists had worked with Reformed and Roman Catholics. And why, they asked, could this cooperation not continue in peacetime? Increasingly, people deserted their own pillar to vote for a national party, usually a socialist one. The Roman Catholic and Reformed parties had stood the tent for a while, but by the 1970s, it was clear that the old system of pillars had been mistaken. Secularization engulfed the country, bringing rid of the erasure of religious and worldview boundaries. There were exceptions to this trend, however. Some Reformed people continued to believe in the need for separate action in politics and in other areas. Prominent among them were members of the liberated Reformed churches. In 1948, well before the demise of the Anti-Revolutionary Party, these people broke with that party and established their own, the GPB, the Reformeerde Politieke Verbond. There was more than one reason for the break. It took place 4 years after the church liberation or Vrijmaking of 1944. And in the early years, Dutch church was faced with a so-called ethical conflict between the liberated and the so-called systematicals. Organizers of the new party also raised objections to the fact that the anti-revolutionary party was non-confessional and interdenominational. A confessional foundation, that is a foundation on the three forms of unity, had been avoided on principle as being unnecessary for politics. The basis of the anti-revolutionary party was simply the confession of God's sovereignty and the authority of the Bible. In practice, this meant that Christians could become party members regardless of church affiliation, including, for example, Baptists. The founders of the new GPB, on the other hand, believed that a truly Christian party should be based on the Reformed confessions. They further rejected any kind of interdenominationalism and held that their party should consist of members of the liberated churches only. And so the GPB denied membership to people of other churches, no matter how orthodox or how sympathetic to its political program. Now, this was a radical departure from tradition, and it threatened to restrict the new party's outreach quite considerably. Not nearly everybody therefore agreed with the approach. Case Hilder was among those who warned against it, arguing that by establishing their own separate party, the liberated churches would marginalize themselves and be unable to influence. politics. So that eventually broke with the anti-revolutionary party, but he never joined the GPD. That party's existence during the first years was precarious. Many church members continued to reject the political break. After the schism of the 1960s, however, when some 30,000 people left the liberated churches, attitudes changed. For a while, the churches would present a more united front in politics and other matters, and the new party began to flourish. In 1963, it had been able to send its first representative to Parliament, and eventually a second seat was drawn. By the 1970s and 80s, when the old anti-revolutionary party disappeared from the scene, its successor was well established. Also well established by this time was the new phase of polarization in the Netherlands. Although it was on a much smaller scale than before, there were close resemblances. As we had the first phase, divisions were drawn in practically all areas of life. In addition to their separate political party, members of the liberated churches have their own newspapers, their own socio-economic organizations, their own elementary and secondary schools, colleges, institutions of care, and so on. A striking difference with the first phase was that the lines of separations were drawn not only with respect to the world, but also with respect to other Christians. Reformed believers stood themselves up against the world and against each other. This situation lasted for some years, but the end opposition against a radically exclusivist approach revived and gained in strength. In the 1970s, non-liberated reformed people who had supported the GPD but had been refused membership established their own party. And this factor, combined with other developments to which I will get attention later, convinced GPD leaders that interdenominational cooperation was necessary if the reform voice was to be heard at all. In the year 2000, the two small reform parties finally united under the name Christian Union. This type of departure from the very much tradition of polarization plays not only in politics, but in other areas as well. The Reform Daily newspaper, for example, also loosened its ties with the liberated churches and accepted editors from other circles. Attempts for a union with other Reformed churches were also intensified. The departure from the liberated Reform isolationism has been met with relief by a good number of church people in the Netherlands, but there are also many opponents. In fact, the new approach played a role in yet another secession, the so-called New Liberation, New Brainerdy, which so far has attracted some 1,250 members. But these secessionists are not alone in that protest. The divisions run through the churches. The arguments that are marshaled on either side are of interest, and I will give an overview of the deliberations. We begin with those who oppose cooperation. I already touched upon their arguments, so that it can be brief. Firstly, these people reject Abraham Kuyper's theory of visible and invisible church and the pluriformity of the church. Referring to Articles 27 through 29 of the Bell's Confession, they conclude that there can be only one true church in any location. Other churches are by definition false, and any sort of cooperation with them is out of the question. Even the willingness by their members to subscribe to the often, nor had he often felt compassion either regret. Dr. Dowell and others also questioned the idea that the ecclesiastical divisions among Christians must lead to separation in all areas. They point out that that conclusion also was not known in the past. It was only after the Grand Larkin that interdenominationalism per se was seen as heresy. Before 1944, Reformed theologians, including men like Hayes Filmer and Lee Holliday, saw no problem whatsoever in cooperating with other Christians in a variety of areas, including politics and the schools. As we've seen, even after 1944, Silver believed that political cooperation with other Christians should be possible. Neither did these theologians insist that all such cooperation must be based on the Reformed confessions. There was widespread agreement in the view of Dr. Herman Babbage, who had said that the extent to which the confessions have to play a role depends on the field of engagement. Babbage distinguished four areas, namely evangelism, the work of charity, education, and politics. With respect to evangelism, he said, cooperation between people who did not adhere to the same confessions and did not go to the same church was virtually impossible. The objections were not as strong, however, in the case of education and work of charity, and even less so in politics. Dharma is among those who agree with this view. He asks opponents to explain why confessional statements about the church, for example, or about infant baptism, should have any bearing on politics. Dharma admits that participation would be impossible if a political party should ask us to deny our confessions. But if this is not the case, he asks, why should we refuse to work with others for the good of the nation? The other case of amalgamation justified the position also with practical arguments. They pointed, for example, to the decline in the number of GPV supporters in recent years. A new generation has arisen that does not see the issues of 1944 as politically relevant and that demands cooperation with other committed Christians. It does so at a time when the urgency for such cooperation becomes more and more evident. An early warning sign was the introduction in 1981 of the concept law for equal treatment, a law that could make it possible, it was feared, that Reformed schools would have to hire homosexual teachers. Issues like same-sex marriage and the legalization of abortion and euthanasia became additional reasons to seek political cooperation with fellow believers. So did European integration and a desire to have a Christian voice in European Parliament. Those favoring amalgamation have offered reasons of a different nature as well. They concern not only cooperation with fellow believers, but the legitimacy of Christian organization as such. The question is being asked, for example, if the practice of polarization has not been counterproductive. Delmer mentions an article by evangelical author Oliver R. Barclay, who sharply criticizes the Dutch tradition of polarization. Barclay argues that the system of separate Christian organizations has contributed to the rapid pace of secularization in the Netherlands. It is among the reasons he believes why the level of public morality in that country is lower than in other parts of Europe, where Christians have continued to work in mixed organizations. Although Dharma rejects the idea that we should get rid of our Christian organizations, he admits that an important point has nevertheless been made. Christians are salt and a light in the world. They are not to hoard the salt for themselves and shine the light only within their own organizations and in their own circles. These organizations are important as means of preparing believers for their task in the world. They become a stumbling block and a liability, however, if they serve as fortresses that Christians erect for their own protection and benefit. Gerrit J. Schutter, leader of the GPB in its final years, agrees that the danger to which Bharti and Dharma refer is a real one. Pillarization in the Reformed tradition, he points out, had as goal the re-Christianing of the nation and used as means the establishment of separate organizations. The means succeeded very well, but the goal was not reached. The result of pillarization has all too often been to protect one's own Christian group rather than to offer help to a country in need. Indeed, the fortress mentality has been so strong that one no longer knew even one's fellow believers in other churches. There's considerable irony here. The reason why Reformed people engage in politics is that confession that all of life belongs to Christ, a separatist and a Baptist kind of isolationism from society, is therefore out of the question. Yet the history of Reformed politics in the Netherlands shows that polarization, separate Christian organizations, can in practice lead to such isolationism. To conclude, in this brief and admittedly very incomplete description of Reformed politics in the Netherlands, I've drawn quite a bit of attention to the mistakes that can be made when as Christians we become politically involved. I did not do so to discourage Christian political outreach, which I'm convinced is necessary. We are members of society, shared in its guilt, and must work for its peace and welfare. Concretely, this means that we are to remind rulers and citizens of God's sovereignty over all of life and of the requirement to honor his commands. Organized political action can be an important means to fulfill this task. But in making use of that means, we must be aware of potential dangers. My study of Dutch polarization in particular, and of Christian political activity in general, suggests to me that we should guard especially against the following drawbacks or pitfalls. Pitfall number one, believing that our political cooperation must necessarily be restricted to members of our own churches or professional circles. I think we should keep in mind Dr. Bavink's argument on this point, as well as Reformed practice in the Netherlands before 1944. Pitfall number two, withdrawing into our own organization and neglecting the needs of society. I'm referring here to Albert Barclay's charge that by circling the wagons, Dutch Christians have failed in their responsibility towards society and so contributed to its rapid moral decline. Although Canada does not lend itself to the type of polarization that we had in the Netherlands, the danger of forgetting that we are a salt and a light in the world confronts us as well. To the extent that we ignore this danger as Christians, we are not only the victims, but also among the causes of the secularizing trend. Pitfall number three, misunderstanding the nature of our political task. The political duty of Christians is not to safeguard their own particular group, nor is it to declare warfare on the rest of society and act as one of so many special interest groups, us versus them mentality. To repeat what I said before, our political task is to promote the peace and well-being of society. We fulfill it by reminding rulers and citizens that a turning away from the biblical moral code is to court disaster. Social well-being depends on obedience to God's laws, which are laws of life and therefore the best possible ones for all people. This must be the primary political message. Pitfall number four, failing to realize that a message must be delivered wisely, intelligently, and with an expert understanding of the issues involved. If we want to have a choice, a voice in the courts of the nation, we'd better know what we are doing. society. And political organization is a means of doing that. But if the truth would be proclaimed, it must also be demonstrated. This means that it must be modeled in the daily life of Christians. In the words of an American evangelical author, and I quote, "The kingdom of God is best spread not when we force its ethics on others, but when we demonstrate through tender care for our own and our neighbors what the gospel looks like." End of quotation. And that labor, incidentally, may be an abortionist or a militant homosexual. These speak louder than words. The time may come that a life of modeling the truth of the gospel is the only means left to us to fulfill our political task. Such a situation would not be unprecedented. It existed in the early church, and it still exists today, namely in countries where there is no freedom of speech, association, and religion. In Canada, however, we still have these freedoms, and political engagement in the customary sense of the term remains possible. We should make use of that opportunity, all the while helping each other to find the criteria for truly Christian politics. I sincerely hope that this conference will make an important contribution to that end. Thank you.